Welcome to the Cool Mason Show!
The Whiz Kids had won it, Bobby Thompson had done it, and Yogi read the comics all the while. Rock and roll was being born, marijuana we would scorn. So down on the corner, the national pastime went on trial. We're talking baseball, Klazuski Campanella. Talking baseball, the man and Bobby fella, the scooter, the barber and the nuke. They knew them all from Boston to Dubuque, especially Willie, Mickey and the Duke. Well, Casey was winning, Hank Aaron was beginning, one Robbie going out, one coming in. Kiner and Midget Goodell, the Thumper and Mel Parnell, and Ike was the only one winning down in Washington. I'm talking baseball, Klazuski Campanella. Talking baseball, the man and Bobby fella, the scooter, the barber and the duke. They knew them all from Boston to Dubuque, especially Willie, Mickey and the Duke. Now my old friend, the Bachelor, well, he swore he was the Oklahoma kid. And Cookie played hooky to go and see the Duke. And me, I always loved Willie May. Those were the days. Well, now it's the 80s, and Brett is the greatest, and Bobby Bonds can play for everyone. Rose is at the vet, Rusty again is a Met, and the great Alexander is pitching again in Washington. I'm talking baseball, like Reggie, Queasy, and Berry. Talking baseball, Carew and Gaylord Perry, Seaver, Garvey, Schmidt, and Vida Blue. And it's no fluke, they'll be with Willie, Mickey and the Duke. Willie, Mickey and the Duke.
Say hey, say hey, say hey.
It was Willie, Mickey and the Duke.
Say hey, say hey, say hey.
I'm talking Willie.
Welcome to the Phil Mason Show. That was Terry Cashman, Willie, Mickey, and the Duke talking baseball. It is Monday afternoon, the 17th of June, 2013, and that's exactly what we're going to do today is talk baseball at 5 p.m. Eastern on Max Sports Channels and again at 10 p.m. Eastern on Talk Superstation. Joining me today from SBNation.com/MLB, as well as PinstripedBible.com. Please welcome Mr. Stephen Goldman to the show. Thanks, Stephen, for being here. How are you tonight?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm fantastic, man. I'm looking forward to talking baseball because I didn't get my fix on Friday, and it was awful. It made for a bad weekend all the way around. But we had a lot of interesting things happen this week. And since you were here last week, the biogenesis thing, not much there really. Wasn't there something about a judge overturned something?
Oh, yes. Well, the baseball has pursued kind of a novel legal strategy in terms of trying to get cooperation from the biogenesis guys. They are suing them individually on the grounds of tortious interference. Now, I am far, far from a lawyer. My main qualification for discussing anything legal is that for about 15 minutes in 1993, I thought about going to law school. So take everything that I'm about to say with the appropriate grain of thought, but or grain of salt, I should say, although grain of thought is an interesting concept. Tortious interference is when someone who's not a party to a contract interferes with somebody fulfilling that contract between two parties. So let's say that you and I agree to make some kind of transaction. I wrote about this recently, and I used my colleague Rob Nyer as an example. Say that I agreed to sell Rob Nyer a comic book for $10, and you came along and offered me $15 after Rob and I had already signed a contract to have that sale take place. Well, at that point, if I turned around, broke the contract, and gave you the comic book, Rob could sue me for breach of contract, and he could sue you for tortious interference, that is, you know, inviting me to break that contract. So when it comes to biogenesis, the idea is that Tony Bosch and the people working with him, by offering these players a way of cheating on the joint drug agreement and not getting caught, was interfering in a contract between the players and the owners, or Major League Baseball, that they would not use them. Now, there are a lot of reasons why that might not work, and the defendants have been trying to get it thrown out. A judge in Florida declined to do that. So apparently at least one legal mind does think that there is some validity to the strategy.
And his mind is probably a lot bigger than ours, at least in terms of law. But the whole thing sounds bizarre. And after last week's show, Stephen, someone wrote to me, and I didn't even bother to even mention it to you, but someone wrote to me and said, does it even matter that these guys are using performance-enhancing drugs? What do you think about it? Because I thought about that all week, and I start to wonder, does it really matter?
It really depends on what you think the effect of those drugs are. And we got into this a little bit last week. But again, you know, we talked about recovery. But, you know, recovery is a very slippery thing, right? I mean, in terms of these things allowing you to hit balls over buildings, there's not a lot of evidence that that's the case, or that would be the case. And to the extent that offense went up, there were a lot of other things going on, from changes in the ball to changes in the ballpark to environmental conditions, where you can say, you know, we cannot exclude all those things and just zero in on performance enhancing drugs. Plus you throw in that, you know, the vast majority of guys who have gotten caught doing things are not Mark McGwire or Rafael Palmeiro. There are guys who, if you can find an improvement, they went from 3 home runs to 4 home runs. So I don't want to appear naive, but there isn't this big correlation between use and suddenly becoming Superman. Now, you brought up recovery. Recovery is an interesting question. What do you think is allowable for recovery and what isn't? You know, I mean, aspirin, if you're stiff after a workout and you take some aspirin and that allows you to work out longer, that's cheating the natural process of recovery by some definition. If you're tired and you drink a cup of coffee or you pick up a can of Red Bull, that is cheating the natural process of recovery, which actually requires you to, you know, make up your sleep deficit and take a nap for half a day. So it all depends where you draw the line in terms of what you think is an acceptable addition to the ball player's medicine cabinet in terms of getting over things. I mean, a Band-Aid is a performance enhancing thing in a way, because, you know, without that Band-Aid, you might get infected and not be able to play if you cut your knee. So this is, you know, it's really very dependent on your individual tolerance for what you think sports is and to what degree you think sports should represent just, you know, man nakedly, and, you know, not literally, but figuratively nakedly, pursuing athletic achievement.
You know, that's just it. And the other thing too is this, what about Tommy John surgery? Isn't that a performance enhancing drug too? Or doesn't that enhance the performance?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, look, in the old days, you know, you a catcher broke his finger on a foul tip, they would say, spit on it, rub some dirt on it, and keep going.
Exactly.
And if you look at pictures of old-time catchers and their fingers, you know, their hands look like 1,000 miles of broken road because of what they went through. So, I mean, yeah, any medical intervention, right, is any substance that you take, and it could be Flintstones chewable vitamins. I mean, anything that you do in that regard is essentially altering the hand that nature dealt. So, like I said, it's where you draw the line. And if you have this perception that the drugs that baseball players have used are indeed performance enhancing, and again, that is unproven in a lot of ways, you know, then you're going to have a stricter definition than some other people do. But it seems to me that, you know, Bud Selig and everybody else has kind of surrendered to a false equivalency between baseball and things like track and field, where maybe the line between taking some of these substances and performance is a little bit clearer. Here, you're not running, you know, in a straight line over a short period of time in a sprint or anything, or you or even cycling for a long distance. You're performing this incredible act of eye-hand coordination and muscle memory to throw or hit a baseball. And it's entirely more complicated than that.
That's exactly right. And I was listening to ESPN's Baseball Tonight this week. I don't remember what night it was on, but Buster Olney was talking about Ryan Madsen. And all this guy wants to do is pitch, and he's having difficulties because the muscles haven't grown and attached themselves to the tendon yet, which is slowing down his recovery. And he's speculating. Now, he's not doing this, Ryan Madsen, of course. But he's thinking, now, couldn't HGH help me? Because that's what it actually is meant to do. That's what they right. give people who have surgeries all the time. They give them these things because it's a medical equivalent to I don't even know how to say it. Recovery. What do you think about Ryan Madsen? All this guy wants to do is do what he does best. Shouldn't he be allowed to do that? Would that be a performance-enhancing drug?
No, I don't think so. And I mean, again, like, you can look up any number of controlled substances. Let's put aside human growth hormone for a second. There are clinical uses for marijuana. We know that. There are clinical uses for cocaine, although, you know, it's very hard to get a license to not that I've looked into this, by the way, but I've read that the
government – Yeah, be government careful now. You've got a lot of fans out there.
No, that's I've never even been drunk, to be honest. I just have kind of entirely ignored that phase of life. But there are therapeutic purposes for almost every chemical that's out there, and or even LSD. People think that it might have psychiatric applications, in terms of treating depressives and other psychological ailments. So when you look at something like HGH and you say, well, we've painted it as a bad thing, but yes, it could have a therapeutic purpose, and why shouldn't he be able to use it in that way? Again, it's not like Marvel comic books. It's you're not going to turn into the Incredible Hulk or get superpowers. You know, I've had cancer twice and been treated with radiation, and I being a comic book fan going back to when I was a little kid, I thought, hopefully I didn't think this seriously, but it was kind of nice to joke with myself and say, you know, out of this process, I will get X-ray vision. And we'll spend the rest of my time hanging around girls' locker rooms, or I should say women's locker rooms, and satisfying my most base desires. This is the reward that I get for having cancer, but no, not so much. The main thing I get out of that is blindness. So, I mean, everything. You know, some things, the same things that will hurt you will heal you, and vice versa. And it's just a matter of where you draw the line.
Exactly. That's a good way to end that, because this is a crazy topic sometimes, that's for sure. I'll tell you what, though. Something that was really crazy was what happened the other night in L.A. What in the world? Zach Greinke, can you break it down for us? Because that was crazy.
It's kind of difficult to break down in that it's got as many chapters as maybe the three books of The Lord of the Rings. There was so much going on there.
Good analogy.
But essentially, earlier in that game, Greinke had hit Ross, Cody Ross of the Diamondbacks. It didn't appear to be intentional, but a little bit later, Ian Kennedy threw a pitch up and in to Yasiel Puig that hit him in the face. He was okay. He stayed in the game. Even that might not have been intentional. Kennedy, I don't recall if he led the league or tied for the league in hit by pitches last year, but it's very strange that a guy who is not a stuff guy throws, you know, on average 89-90 and succeeds on his command would hit so many batters, but he does hit a lot of guys. So that happened. There was clearly a retaliatory pitch by Greinke that hit Miguel Montero, the cleanup hitter for the Diamondbacks. Their catcher hit him in the back. So even though it was almost certainly retaliatory, it was at least as safe as those things can be under the circumstances. But then when Greinke came to the plate, subsequently, Kennedy threw a pitch up and in the region of his head. And at that point, you know, that was the second time benches cleared. The first time that benches cleared, you know, it was the usual, you know, milling about and dancing and nothing, you know, nothing really happened. But the second time, a full-fledged fight broke out. And you know, in the ensuing suspensions, Ian Kennedy received the hardest penalty, a 10-game suspension for throwing at Greinke.
It was a crazy thing. When I saw the replay, because I was recording my show, as you know, I'm recording during these times.
Right.
I'm looking at this thing, and the first thing I thought was when I saw Alan Trammell on the ground and Don Mattingly over top of him, I'm thinking, let's go back to 1984. That was crazy. But this Ian Kennedy, 10 games, that really doesn't amount to anything because they can doctor it around, move it around, and they won't even miss him. The one suspension that I didn't – well, there's actually a couple I didn't understand. The first one was, what in the world did Eric Hinsky do?
Yeah, it's not really clear when you look at the films that that he was particularly culpable in anything that happened. I guess he was one of the first guys on the field, and maybe they're pursuing something similar to the NBA idea of the first man off the bench. I don't know, but it's possible he was misidentified, but you would think that on appeal, his suspension might be reduced because, you know, he wasn't one of the more egregious performers there. I mean, you know, J.P. Howell taking Turner Ward, the coach for the Diamondbacks, and bending him over the railing like that. I mean, that was frightening and unusual for a baseball brawl. But Hinsky didn't really seem to do anything except actually be hit by Puig subsequent to coming on the field. So I'm with you. I don't quite get that.
And bringing up J.P. Howell, that was crazy because he received 2 games. And that seemed to be the worst part of the whole thing because he had Ward just pinned.
Right.
I mean, it looked like a hockey fight when the plexiglass broke. I mean, really.
You know, baseball's deterrent, you know, any punishment is meant to have a deterrent effect, right? And baseball's approach to this in recent years has been really, really weak. And, you know, one incident that I had almost forgotten about completely, and it was only 3 years ago, was the fight between the Reds and the Cardinals where Johnny Cueto wound up kind of backed up against the backstop and started flailing away with his feet and kicking guys. And Jason LaRue, who was a backup catcher on the Cardinals at that point, was kicked in the head, and the concussion pretty much ended his career. Of course, that wasn't known at that moment, but that Cueto was kicking people was known, and he received, I believe, 7 games. So, you know, it's laughable, really. It's the equivalent of maybe, depending on, like you said, how teams shuffle things around, maybe it's an inconvenience. Maybe a pitcher misses one start that he would have made. But it's not something that is going to cause people to think twice before doing it again. Until they have negotiated some kind of more severe system of penalties with the Players Association, it's just not going to happen.
And here's the one I really didn't get, is how in the world Yasiel Puig walked away with just a slap on the wrist. because from what I'm looking at this now, I'm over at SB Nation. I'm looking at the GIF, the GIF that.
Yes, sir.
And I'm seeing this guy throw at least two haymakers, man. Now, how is that and running when he does it?
Yeah, and one of them was one that landed on Hinsky. So I don't know. Maybe because Puig was one of those who was the aggrieved parties in the first place. It's hard to know the reasoning behind these things. They don't explain it well. And, it's really not clear what happened here. But keep in mind that – and this is the only thing that I can think of – is that they have more video sources than we might have. That they can look at, or maybe they have some other angles. Maybe there's some other testimony that came into play, but it's very hard to think that there's something that we're missing there that would explain all that.
Yeah, because when I looked back at everything, I'm not so sure that they threw at Puig. I'm sure they obviously they're going to try to back him off the plate because the guy's like the Incredible Hulk standing over there, you know. And then Greinke does his thing. Okay, that's fair enough. He's going to protect the rookie. That's expected. Nothing went on. Even Montero took that well. I mean, he didn't get ticked off, really. And then hell breaks loose.
Yeah, he had to know that was coming. I mean, again, that's old school, tit-for-tat baseball. And that happens all the time. And I think for the most part, it's understood, and guys don't overreact to it. You're right. Look, the whole thing needn't have happened if Kennedy had let it go at that. If, you know, one team's cleanup hitter was hit, the other team's cleanup hitter was hit, and in a biblical sense of an eye for an eye, everybody is satisfied. But Kennedy did escalate it, and he did it in a way that was dangerous, especially given that you're right, he wasn't trying to hit Puig, or at least I don't think so. We can't look into his mind and know, but just he again, for a guy who's all about command, he seems to lack the fine command to pitch in close to guys and not hit them. So when you go up and into a guy, you're courting serious risk there. And, you know, somebody could literally be killed. I realize they have helmets nowadays, so the chances of another Ray Chapman are pretty minimal. I mean, they're minimal in the first place, given that there was just one in the entire history of Major League Baseball, one fatality in 1920. But still, you never know. You never know when there could be the second, just because somebody gets hit at exactly the right angle. So you really do need to do whatever you can to deter that.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things too that came up throughout the blogosphere is how baseball polices itself. And we saw an adequate job of it with Greinke, Plinkin, Montero after three times. Apparently his control isn't as good as Ian Kennedy's when it comes to those things. But what do you think about the entire policing themselves? Is it something that you find acceptable? Because for me, I'm just used to seeing it. I've been watching baseball for 44 years.
You know, yeah, it's something I'm really ambivalent about, in that as someone who loves baseball history and loves that ethic that goes back to the very beginning of the game of about how you don't show up the other guy, about how there's a certain, you know, give and take to these things that we saw to that point in this game. I feel like I wouldn't want to see that go away. And yet there's an adult part of me, or a more sober part of me, that says, well, you know, maybe there's really no place for that in the game today, that these players are worth tens of millions of dollars each. And, you know, if a Puig, who is going to provide a significant uplift to the Dodgers franchise, which is important for baseball, and is a pleasure to watch. I mean, if he's removed from the equation because something is broken or he's injured in some way, then maybe that's a not an acceptable risk for us anymore. And so there's a part of me that says maybe, you know, that has to go the way of sliding spikes high and the rolling block slide on the double play and lots of other things that have gone away because they're just – you know, they're not safe. They're a kind of a harder core baseball than we have right now. But, you know, the main thing is to see guys play baseball to hit and run in field, not necessarily to fight.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'll tell you something else I came away with is a lot of people don't like Zach Greinke, but he's not a bad teammate. He didn't have to go up to bat again. He knew he was getting hit. But the thing is after all the rhubarb ended and the fracas ended, he went in and tried to break up a double play. That's a tough kid. That's a baseball player, isn't he?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, look, maybe he's not Mr. Personality. I mean, look, his emotional problems are well documented, and you know that he deals with social anxiety and things like that are something that many, many people deal with, and they don't have to deal with them in an environment in which people are constantly coming up to you and asking you questions, and you have to do your job on national television. Or even local television, and when you do poorly, everybody can see it and point at you and shout at you. I mean, that's a really hard burden to live up to. So if he's not the greatest guy to hang out with, or he prefers to keep to himself and he just enjoys the playing baseball aspect of playing and not necessarily the media aspect of playing baseball, I don't think that's a problem. I think as long as he performs well, it doesn't matter. So, you know, people may or may not like him, but you know, as long as he's pitching well, he's going to continue to be in demand, and that's the way it should be in baseball, which is, you know, hopefully the ultimate meritocracy, where as long as you play up to a certain level, there's going to be a place for you in the game.
Yep, exactly. You know what? The other thing I was thinking about is this Diamondbacks LA Dodgers thing has been going on a lot longer than. This brawl was kind of the culmination of a lot of things. Do you think it's over? Do you think they settled the score, so to speak?
I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, and guys like Belisario, the Dodgers reliever, have said that it's not over. But you know, these are teams that have a lot at stake. Not so much the Dodgers, who were 10 games under 500, but the Diamondbacks, who are in contention for a division title there, can't really afford to have important players injured or off on suspension when, you know, they only have a half game lead in the division. So you don't want to lose a pennant because, you know, somebody took a ball off the hands or the face or was suspended for another 10 games by baseball. And maybe next time it'll be a position player or somebody that they really will feel the impact of that. And it causes a different outcome than they might have had otherwise. And there's one other thing, which is in the midst of all this, baseball announces that next season, the Diamondbacks and the Dodgers will travel to Australia together and open the season there in late March. So talk about ambassadors for the game. They may get to extend the grudge match to a whole other continent before it's over.
They probably will, and the Australians will love it, by the way. I'm sure they will. Anyway, we're off to a flying start. We have to take a break. And when we return, we're going to take a look at the National League Central. And, of course, we're going to take a look at Stephen's beloved New York Yankees. You're listening to The Phil Nason Show. And we'll be right back.
Ladies and gentlemen,
tonight we come together.
Cool. And I think it's cool.
Somebody's going to be having fun tonight.
All I want to do is go have a good time. It's all about
tonight. Phil Nason.
Some of the things that these people say.
Jimmy Z.
That is such twisted logic.
Alex Jones.
You heard it here first. Now it's mainstream news.
Weeknights starting at 10 Eastern.
Okay, well, let's go party.
Yeah, tomorrow can wait till tomorrow.
Ah, it's a lot of fun.
I said tomorrow can wait till tomorrow. It's all about tonight.
And we'll have fun, I promise.
Yeah, it's all about tonight.
Weeknights on the Talk Superstation.
It's all about tonight.
If you're moving to the Atlanta area or simply looking to buy that new dream home, we'll look no further than to real estate agent Latricia Friesen. Latricia has over 10 years in real estate experience, and she's anxious to put you in your brand new home. For more information, you can contact Latricia at latricia.com. That's LETRISSA.com.
Stitcher Smart Radio is an award-winning, free mobile application that lets you listen to your favorite shows and discover the best of news, entertainment, and sports on demand. Now you don't even need a Wi-Fi or a cell connection to listen to shows like The Phil Nason Show. Never miss another show. It's real simple. Just go to Stitcher.com and download the free app today. And never miss another Phil Nason Show. Are you tired of boring sports websites that's about the same old company line? If you are, then I'd invite you to stop over to thesportsgoons.com. Their edgy commentary and a weekly podcast highlighting today's issues is second to none. That's thesportsgoons.com. The new media has arrived. This Week in Tennis is a weekly tennis program covering all aspects of professional tennis. The most controversial tennis show anywhere deals with issues no one seems to want to touch. For music and hard-hitting commentary, please visit philnasons.com. Looking for the latest information on your favorite sports team? Why not check out 15-year-old founder Trevor Urenz, prosportsextra.com. Updated daily by a staff of over 30 writers, prosportsextra.com is the place to be. You can check them out, and I insist that you do, at prosportsextra.com. Hi, this is Phil Nasons from This Week in Tennis and The Phil Nasons Show. Max Sports Channels offers the best in sports talk radio, as well as great music 24 hours a day. It's my daily destination, and I hope it's yours. The sports talk begins each and every day at 3 p.m. and ends around 9 p.m. Special programming on the weekends. And in between all that, the hottest music on the internet. That's Max Sports Channels. Make it your daily destination. Welcome back to the Phil Nason Show. It's Monday, June the 17th, 2013. Stephen Goldman from SBNation.com/MLB and PinstripeBible.com is here breaking down the baseball, having a great time talking baseball on a Monday afternoon. And the National League Central, Stephen, this is one where at the beginning of the season, I honestly believed, and I've always been like a closet St. Louis Cardinal fan. I just love the way they do things and always have. But I kind of predicted that Cincinnati would run away with this thing, and it just isn't so, is it?
No, and the big difference has been, and like you, I wasn't as high on the Cardinals as I probably should have been. The difference, I think, has been that their starting pitching has been so extraordinary that heading into Sunday's games, their staff ERA for starting pitching was 2.88. So, and that's even with a lot of injuries. Jamie Garcia, Jake Westbrook on the DL, Chris Carpenter, who knows if he'll even be back for the rest of his career. Even with that going on, they have this ERA well below three and a very good, not great, but very good offense, a deep offense where they have Matt Adams, a guy who could probably start for 29 other teams and hit 35 home runs coming off the bench because he's stuck behind Alan Craig. They can, move Matt Carpenter around from second to third base, and he's got a 400 on-base percentage at the top of that order and leading the league in runs scored. I mean, it's just a very deep, very versatile club. And I'll tell you what should have been the clue for us during the offseason, and it was the whole Kyle Loesch thing. when they were really happy to let Kyle Loesch go to another club. And the reason for that was they knew that they had this depth in starting pitching, that they knew that Shelby Miller was going to be on this staff and had every chance to be excellent. Maybe they didn't anticipate he'd be as excellent as he has been with a 2.21 ERA to this point. But, you know, they knew that they had the depth and that they had guys like Trevor Rosenthal, who if they didn't want to put him in the bullpen, he could start. I mean, they had all these options, and that's probably the reason that we should have been a little higher on them in the first place.
And that's just it. They have this Cardinal way, and these young kids, they come in and fill the blanks. But you're right, Kyle Loesch should have been the indicator, and we all missed it. Or not all of us, probably, but I know I did. But St. Louis is looking pretty good. They have a 2.5-game lead over Cincinnati. What do you think is the difference between Cincinnati this season and last season? Because I think it's Johnny Cueto, actually.
Well, you know, he's been in and out a lot, and that's been a problem, obviously. But they've also gotten very good pitching from the rookie Tony Cingrani when Cueto hasn't been around. So if you add them together and consider them kind of one pitcher, you get about 13 starts and you get a 7-0 record or something like that, and an ERA of probably somewhere around 2.5. So it's hard to say that that's hurt them as much. I think that the offense hasn't been quite as good. They're a very impatient team in some ways, except for, you know, and I say that even though Sinshu Chu and Joey Votto are both on paces for 100 walks or well over 100 walks, I guess the reason for my saying that is that Zach Cozart is up towards the top of the order with an on-base percentage of 270, something like that. It's one of those really hard things to figure out. I feel like that's really what it is, that the whole is less than the sum of the parts, in part because, you know, Dusty Baker is just a bit reluctant to optimize that batting order and squeeze out as many runs as he probably could from the group of guys that he has.
The other one that hasn't played the way he did last year is Todd Frazier. You know, he hasn't hit the ball like he did last year in his rookie year, and I think that has a lot to do with where they're at too, but they're certainly not out of the woods. And what about Pittsburgh? Now, I always predict, well, I have the last 3 years, I predicted this year, that they would fall away. Thus far, they haven't. What do you think about Pittsburgh?
It's going to be hard for them to fall away this year with being 13 games over. I mean, I know there's a good deal of baseball left, probably about 94, 95 games for them still to play, so anything could happen. But right now it would take a major reversal of fortune for them to fall away. I mean, they've gotten great results out of the bullpen. The starting pitching has been excellent. A.J. Burnett just went on the DL, but he's been everything he wasn't for the Yankees. Jeff Locke, who's more of a pitch to contact guy, has been excellent. Liriano is pitching in a way that the Twins couldn't figure out how to get him to pitch that well for years and years. I mean, there's a lot of good things happening, and you know, the offense is, you know, just okay. Guys like Pedro Alvarez have a whole lot of home runs, but not a lot else. There's not a great deal of power over the rest of that lineup. So, you know, it's hard to say, you know, whether they'll be able to keep it up on that side of the ball. But and they've probably been a little lucky, you know, but on the whole, you know, you have to say this is not a bad team.
Yeah, I'm starting to become more of a believer because, I've seen them skid the last couple seasons. And, you know, losing Burnett's going to be hard, but they have this rookie kid. Did you see him pitch the other night, Garrett Cole, right?
Yeah, he's a really interesting story. And one that, just to bring in the Yankees connection for a minute, he was drafted by the Yankees coming out of high school. And they thought they had a deal with him. And at the last minute, he reversed himself and went to college. I don't think that they did anything wrong. I don't know that there was bad faith on either side. But for whatever reason, things fell apart very quickly and were at the last minute. And right away, he became one of the top college pitchers in the country. And the Pirates were able to snag him with a first-round draft pick a few years later. And now he's up in the majors at 22. The only thing about him that kind of troubles me, and I haven't seen enough of him to really know what this means, but you know, his strikeout rate this year was well down. You know, last year he was striking out 9-10 per nine innings. That has dropped off to 6 when he was at AAA, and he struck out very few in the couple of starts that he's had at the major league level. So I don't know what's going on there, if that's just an adjustment that he hasn't made yet or if it's a physical problem. But whenever a guy's strikeout rate plummets, I start to get a little paranoid about what is going on in that arm or shoulder.
I'm completely in agreement with you. He's a good little fantasy option, though. But yeah, it'd be interesting to see how he comes out. But it's always – I love watching these young fellows go out there and bring it at the big level. Now, you've got the Cubs and the Milwaukee Brewers. Both of them, I would say they're probably out of it already. What went wrong with the Cubs? I know they had some hope, not a lot of high hopes, but what do you think went wrong with the Cubs this year, thus far?
Well, I mean, they're coming off of a 101 loss season. So, you know, it was year two of a rebuilding. And although we've seen teams go from last to first a few times, it's tough to really jump up. And you know, for all of that, they've, you know, done a half decent job with pitching because they've gotten better than expected performances from kind of retreaded guys like Travis Wood and Scott Feldman. But I mean, first of all, it's demoralizing to lose games in your bullpen. And the Carlos Marmol as closer thing was allowed to go on, you know, probably a little bit longer than it really needed to at this point. And then the other thing was that, some of their young players, particularly Starlin Castro, you know, he got off to a rough start and still hasn't quite hit the way that you would expect him to hit. And given his sort of overall profile, he's a guy who doesn't walk a lot, you know, only has maybe moderate power. So he needs to hit 290, 300 to be a really productive player on offense. And that's important because as far as being a defensive shortstop, he's just okay. He's not a future Gold Glove winner by any means. So I'm really curious about this because he's 23. Again, he can obviously turn it around, but one of the better Cubs prospects is also a shortstop. He's in the low minors, and his name is Javier Baez, and he's having a really nice year for them at High A, where he's slugging about 550. He's got 13 home runs already, and so he's not going to be along anytime soon unless they really accelerate his timetable for some reason. But this guy may eventually make Starlin Castro kind of redundant in Chicago, and you know they could always make him a second baseman or a third baseman if he was going to hit the way that you need him to. But it's going to be kind of interesting to see what role Castro plays in the Chicago rebuilding as time goes by.
That's a great call too, and I'll tell you who I like a lot is this Anthony Rizzo. He is fantastic. I think he's going to be some kind of player. And the pickup they made with Edwin Jackson hasn't been that bad. They just don't score too many runs when he pitches. But the Brewers, what went wrong there? Injuries? Is it just they are far more overrated?
No, I mean, I think injuries were part of it. For example, you know, Corey Hart has been out all year with knee problems, and they were not able to or chose not to, I'm not sure which, find an adequate replacement at first base, such that, you know, you have Unieski Betancourt, who's not a good hitter for a shortstop, playing first. And he had some hot streaks early on, which actually helped a little bit. But since then, he's been kind of a disaster. And it's just hard to win when you're not getting anything like offense from those positions. But, I mean, more than that, just the pitching has been hellishly bad. And, you know, there's really nobody, perhaps with the exception of Kyle Loesch, who we mentioned before, having anything like a decent season in their starting rotation. Giovanni Gallardo has been very inconsistent. Everybody else has just been borderline disastrous, really. And then they also had problems in the back end of their bullpen trying to figure out how to close games. And lately they've gone back to Francisco Rodriguez, and that's worked out fairly well. But they also, you know, had some losses in the pen that they couldn't really afford to take. And just in general, it's been pitching. You know, their ERA is last in the league, and they probably deserve to be there.
Absolutely, they do. All right, you know what? It's going to be interesting to see how things progress before the trade deadline and what people do. Now, the New York Yankees, your beloved New York Yankees, and so many other of my listeners' beloved New York Yankees. I didn't realize, Stephen, that I had so many Yankee fans that actually listened to this show, because you know we're pretty Mets-centric here when it comes to baseball. But what's happening down in the Bronx?
Not a lot of hitting. Of course, they're not in the Bronx or haven't been in the Bronx this week. They've been taking the dreaded West Coast road trip, with stops most recently at Oakland and Anaheim, and until Sunday, where they barely held on to win a game. They had lost five straight, and it was just a very, very difficult trip. Climaxed maybe not so much by the win on Sunday as by Mark Teixeira being sent back to New York to have his wrist re-examined.
That's a tough injury. I know tennis players who've done that. I've done that myself. And I said, don't even count on this guy for a year, because that's his backhand. That's when, if you're a tennis player, your right hand, you're hitting backhands, that's when it's going to be affected the most. And that seems to be the case here, is batting left-handed, his downhand. What do you think is going to happen with him?
It's hard to know. Like, as you alluded to just now, wrist injuries don't seem to heal very, very easily. And we've seen over and over again with guys who had breaks or had tendon or ligament problems that they may get healthy enough to play as far as a doctor is concerned. Yes, you know, the wrist is healed in a technical sense, but in terms of being healthy enough to hit, that's a whole different story. And so, you know, what Teixeira has right now, according to the latest reports, is just inflammation. And he was given a cortisone shot. So we might expect that he'll be out for a couple of more weeks to let that swelling go down. So it's possible the Yankees will make a move tomorrow, or I should say Tuesday, which is an off day for the Monday, which is an off day for the team, pardon me, to get another bat up there and give Teixeira a chance to rest. But as you said, it could be an ongoing thing, and the example everyone points to last year was Jose Bautista of the Blue Jays, who was always on the verge of coming back, and you know, was back very briefly and then right back out again for the year. You know, there's an old expression: don't look for me until you see me coming, and that's what wrist injuries seem to be like. You know, don't expect Teixeira to be there and productive until you really see him have a run of sustained success, because this could be an issue all year long.
Yeah, it could be. And that's a shame, because when he's hitting, he's a thing to watch, isn't he?
Well, yeah, except that, I mean, not to be a wet blanket about it, but for the last 3 years, you know, 2010, 11, 12, he's been kind of consistently just okay. Not the guy who's making what I think $22.5 million every year. He's been a, you know, 250 hitter with some power, you know, some walks, and he hasn't been bad in any sense, but he also hasn't been the top of the line first baseman that the Yankees got in their first year that they had him. And he's still signed for many more years than this. So you'd like to see that he can come back, and you were hoping this year not only break that streak of just being okay, but maybe get back to being the kind of player he was before that. Now, I guess it may not be this year that happens. Maybe it will be next year, but you know, he'll be 34 next year. He's not getting any younger, and you know, we could be having this conversation again straight through 2016.
You're right, we could. What do you like about Derek Jeter, the possibility of him coming back by the All-Star break? Have you heard that?
Yeah, I mean, maybe guys are starting to move a little faster than you might have expected. It's going to be very strange in a way, because Jeter, you know, has not been for a long time a great defensive shortstop, if he ever was one. And I mean, you know this. I think everybody who follows the Yankees knows he was great on certain plays. He was able to go way to his right, do that jump throw over to first base. He was probably as good going back on pop-ups over his head as anybody I've ever seen. But in terms of balls that were hit up the middle, hit to his left, there was something always a bit slow about his first step. And the result was that he was overall a shortstop who was better for being a bat who could play that position adequately than he was a great defender. And I know he won a bunch of gold gloves, but as I wrote somewhere at one point, you know, peel the foil off of those and there's some nice chocolate beneath. That's really all the, as deep as the gold is on those awards. So here's the thing. Here's a guy who is close to 40, who's coming off an ankle injury where flexibility may not be what it used to be, and who already had a problematic first step, and you're going to ask him to play shortstop every day. I don't know if that's a realistic thing to do. When you look back over the history of baseball at how many shortstops at his age have played a whole season, and again, putting aside the injury, just how many guys have even been asked to do it, the list is very, very short. It's about four or five guys long, and it includes guys like Hans Wagner and Luke Appling, and more recently, Omar Vizquel. And, you know, Omar Vizquel was always a much better glove than Derek Jeter was. And the reason wasn't that there are so few, wasn't that they couldn't have been put out there if somebody had wanted them to, but it was judged that somebody younger was going to be a better defensive player at that point. And for most shortstops, unlike Jeter, there wasn't an offensive reason to sort of live with the defensive shortcomings. So even before or without the injury, Jeter was going to be asked to do something that pretty much one other player since World War II has been asked to do. And the odds of that seem to me to be very, very low. So even though they've gotten relatively less offense or very little offense compared to what Jeter would do at his best, or even what the rest of the league has gotten, they may very well have gotten better defense than they would have gotten had he been around. So what if you bring Jeter back, and putting aside the question of whether he hits, but what if, you know, that putting him there severely undermines your pitching staff?
That's exactly right. And that could very well happen, because the reason that the Yankees are still around is because of that pitching, right?
Absolutely. I mean, the whole reason that you know, everybody was wrong to write them off as soon as all these injuries hit, to A-Rod, to Teixeira, to Curtis Granderson, was because they still had these very good pitchers. They had that deep bullpen headed up by Rivera and Robertson. They had Sabathia and who, of course, in the spring we couldn't have known was going to be pitching at a lower velocity, but for all that has done pretty well. Hiroki Kuroda is just the consummate pro. And so they've been able to survive a lot just on that pitching depth. And if you start handicapping this team on balls in play, then you're attacking it in the one place where it has, you know, an inarguable strength. So yeah, Jeter will come back and everybody will say, hooray, Jeter's back. And it will be great to see him back, because despite the rah-rahing on the part of the team broadcasters, I mean, Jason Nix is just a good utility player, if that. But it might actually be kind of a situation where you get what you wanted, but you lost what you had.
That's a great answer. You know what? I'm enjoying David Robertson, because my favorite saber metric, I guess, is holds, and he has 14 of them, and that means he's getting the job done. He's handing the ball to Mariano, and Mariano's got 24 saves. This pitching staff is a lot better than people think, isn't it?
You know, my favorite thing about Joe Girardi, and I have some issues with him, but my favorite thing about him is that, unlike his predecessor Joe Torre, he's willing to try people in the bullpen and you know, give people roles that they might not have had before. And if you look at the whole of Joe Torre's stay with the Yankees, you say, what relievers did he start out? What did he give the Yankees in terms of arms that they didn't have before established in the major league bullpen? You start with Mariano Rivera, and the list pretty much ends there. And with Rivera, Buck Showalter had pointed the way for him in the playoffs the year before. Once you get past Rivera, he just would not try somebody who was not a Jeff Nelson or a Mike Stanton who had had something like a previous track record. You can kind of point to Tanyan Sturt, sort of, or, you know, one or two other guys kind of on the fringes of the bullpen. But for the most part, that's the whole list. For Girardi, he has a whole bunch of other guys, and Robertson is one of them in the setup role. And it's truly been a pleasure to watch him over the past few years. He can be scary sometimes. He can't always control his pitches, and so he has that Houdini reputation for walking himself into trouble and then striking people out. But man, it's been five and a half years now, and it works really well.
It works really well. Now we've got about a minute and a half left. You've got two big series coming up. You've got the Dodgers, two games with them and four games with Tampa Bay. What are you looking to see this week?
Well, with the Dodgers, you just hope that they win it. I mean, there's going to be a lot of sentimental stuff going on because it's Don Mattingly coming back, because the Yankees and the Dodgers have fought a whole bunch of historic World Series, particularly when the team was in Brooklyn, but also 77, 78, and 81, which I'm just old enough to be a really painful memory for me. And you just hope that they do well because, look, this Dodgers team is not a very good one, and they should win those games at home. In terms of the Rays, these are in-division games. They and the Rays are more or less pacing each other right now, falling behind the Red Sox and the Orioles, and the Yankees will have to continue to pitch well and hopefully, out-hit them once again in their own ballpark.
Excellent stuff tonight, Stephen. Thanks so much for being a part of it.
Always a pleasure.
All right. You can find Stephen Goldman over at SBNation.com/MLB as well as PinstripedBible.com. And that's going to wrap it up for today's Phil Nason Show. Special thanks once again to Stephen for just breaking down baseball, having a great time talking baseball. Tomorrow night, Nick Falk and I from RotoWire will be bringing you the Fantasy Baseball Tuesday. Until then, y'all take care of yourselves. Be good. And most importantly, thanks for listening. Good night.
Ladies and gentlemen, my mother thanks you, my father thanks you, my sister thanks you, and I thank you.